Good evening. This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday night, February 10th, 2021. This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. We're with you tonight and plan to be with you for each 7 p.m. edition of our show the rest of this week, even though our noon shows are preempted for NPR's special coverage of the impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump in the United States Senate. That special coverage is scheduled to resume tomorrow at 11 a.m. on KUAF. You can also go to KUAF.com for gavel-to-gavel live coverage of the proceedings. And there will be full coverage of everything that happened the day before in the trial on the next day's morning edition from 5 to 9 on 91.3 KUAF. Ahead tonight on our show, the Washington County Quorum Court discusses CARES money, more than $4 million worth of funds, and Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek joins me via Zoom to give us an update. Plus, another trial, this one from 19 years ago and more than 100 years ago. We dip into our archives for a story about a reenactment of the trial of Bass Reeves that was staged in Fort Smith this month in 2002. And what Governor Asa Hutchinson and state officials had to say yesterday about vaccinations, COVID-19, and what's next in the Arkansas fight against the pandemic. That's all ahead on this evening edition of Ozarks at Large. A bill proposing to penalize schools using the 1619 Project as a resource for teaching history is not making it out of committee at the state capitol. House Bill 1231, sponsored by Representative Mark Lowry, a Republican from Maumelle, failed in a voice vote in a House committee meeting yesterday. Representative Lowry says he will not bring the bill up for any further consideration during the session. Voters in Gentry are giving approval to Sunday sales of alcohol. By a 2-to-1 margin, residents approved the measure yesterday. Close to 8% of voters in Gentry cast ballots. Nearly 81% of the votes in the Farmington School District yesterday were cast for a school millage. About 2.5% of eligible voters cast ballots there. And in Prairie Grove yesterday, every bond issue on a special election ballot passed by wide margins. Northwest Arkansas National Airport is adding direct flights to Austin, Texas. The flights begin July 2nd and will be available between XNA and Austin Bergstrom International Airport every Friday and Monday afterward. The NAACP Northwest Arkansas branch is hosting a Founders Day celebrating 112 years event on Friday night beginning at 7. The event is open to the public, it's virtual, and it will feature guest speaker Kwame Abdul-Bey with the Arkansas Peace and Justice Memorial Movement. Barry Jefferson, president of Jacksonville NAACP, and Roanne Elliott with the Washington County Remembrance Project will also speak. You can find out more by sending an email to nwanaacp@gmail.com. Most schools, government offices, and some businesses shut their doors today, if they weren't already because of the pandemic, because of inclement weather. Freezing drizzle and other precipitation coated streets and surfaces overnight and during the morning. National Weather Service forecasts continue to have cold for the next several days, lows in the single digits over the weekend. And the Arkansas Razorback men's basketball team enjoying a win over Kentucky for the first time in the last 9 attempts. Arkansas defeated Kentucky 81-80 last night in Lexington to improve to 15-5 overall and 7-4 in the SEC. Good evening. This is Ozarks at Large. More than 330 days into the pandemic, there was a small sliver of optimism embedded in yesterday's press briefing about Arkansas and COVID-19, hosted by Governor Asa Hutchinson and other state officials. To be sure, there was the now familiar bad news. The Arkansas Department of Health counted 42 additional deaths in Tuesday reporting, bringing the state's fatalities from the virus to 5,148. Other numbers this week and last, new cases diagnosed, active cases in the state, and people hospitalized from the disease remain flat or in decline. And vaccines continue to arrive and get distributed in the state. Governor Asa Hutchinson says nearly 13% of Arkansas's residents have received at least a first shot.
That is a huge step forward in our fight against COVID-19. There is some good news. and that is that this week the National Retail Pharmacy Program will be providing a 20% increase in our available doses here in Arkansas. That program is over and above what we do through our retail community pharmacies. This will be through Walmart in 58 Walmart stores, and there'll be 11,000 doses that will be delivered this week to those 58 Walmart stores. They're not there yet. We anticipate that they will be coming this week, and that Friday they'll be able to start administering those doses.
The governor says so far there have been more than 651,000 doses delivered to the state, and more than 413 of those doses, about 65%, have been injected into Arkansans' arms.
People ask, where is the excess there? Well, it's in the pipeline to get out. Sometimes those are second doses, but the first doses are getting into the arms of Arkansans within 72 hours, and we're pushing to continue to improve that.
The governor says additional doses will soon be delivered to community clinics in the state as part of a new effort to help with rural vaccinations. The governor says the announcement from the White House didn't indicate just how many doses would arrive at Arkansas community clinics or when, but he says the intent is to get those vaccines to clinics soon. As of now, the state will continue with shots for the first level of people in the 1B category. That's people 70 and older, and educators in K-12 grades and higher education.
We have to get further into the 70-plus population. Right now, there's too much of a waiting list. There's a greater need there, and so we want to get deeper into that population before we move into additional segments. I do believe that by March 1, we will be able to make additional steps into 1B, but we're going to be monitoring it between now and then to see if that needs to be adjusted anyway.
Arkansas ranks 11th in the country in per capita vaccinations, but the governor says that success rate does not influence the amount of vaccines given to a state. He says that distribution continues on a population basis.
But it does impact our credibility, the confidence level, the partnership, and so we do get accolades for how we are effectively getting the vaccination out, and that is confidence building for what we're doing in this state and increases our partnership. But right now, and I expect that to continue, that it is on a per capita basis. We're going to watch that very closely if that veers from that.
Dr. Jose Romero, Arkansas's Secretary of Health, says a chart that's been used since the first days of these pandemic briefings gives him reason now to be cautiously optimistic.
I think we've reached an important milestone today. As you can see, there's a dotted or hatched line across that slide, and that represents 10% positivity rate. It is the rate that we have been striving to be below. And if you remember, in the early part of the pandemic here in the state, we've always tried to be below that. You can see that it began to tick upward and passed above that 10% line in early November. I'm happy to report today that when combining both the positivity rate for our PCR tests and our antigen tests, we are for the first time under that. We're at 9.9. We hope to continue to see that go downward. It means that our efforts are working, that your efforts are working.
And Dr. Romero says the continued reduction of active cases is also an encouraging sign, and he says the state will continue to hammer home best practices for further slowing the spread through avenues like commercials.
This winter, we must bundle up, not just for warmth, but to control the spread of COVID-19. Wear a face covering, wash your hands, maintain a safe distance from others, and avoid crowded spaces. Get your flu shot now and the COVID-19 vaccine when it's available. We can get back to a better tomorrow by doing the right things today. Learn more at healthy.arkansas.gov.
But the positive signs, fewer active cases, reductions in hospitalizations, the vaccinations can be reversed, state officials warn. Dr. Romero says the Arkansas Department of Health is paying close attention to any possible emergence of variants of COVID-19 in the state, and if Super Bowl parties were catalysts for spread that may not be known for several days. But he says the last week and a half have provided a chance to flatten or reduce the curve.
We have the opportunity now to get ourselves in a situation where we can prevent more cases, where we can continue with these mitigation measures.
And Governor Asa Hutchinson says he isn't ready to declare the crisis over.
There's one thing I've learned through the course of this pandemic, and that is it's hard to predict the future as to where the cases go and whether we're in the eye of the storm or whether we're on a downward slope right now.
The entire briefing can be found at the governor's YouTube page. This is a Wednesday night edition of Ozarks at Large. More than 2 months after receiving several million dollars from the state's allotment of the initial CARES Act funding passed by the federal government last year, Washington County Justices of the Peace held a discussion about how that money should be used. Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek joins me now via Zoom to tell us more about Tuesday night's meeting. Welcome, Zoo.
Hi, Kyle. How are you?
I'm good. Another weird week, but that's what we've expected for the last 11 months, right? We're talking about...
Definitely.
Yes. We're talking about $4.5 million. Let's set the stage before we talk about what was discussed. Where did that money come from?
So back at the start of the pandemic, Arkansas received $1.25 billion in CARES Act funds from the federal government to help weather this crisis. The state had doled out some of that money to counties and cities to reimburse those governments for COVID-19 related expenses. So Washington County received $4.5 million at the end of November. That money is now in the county's general fund and can be spent in whatever way the quorum court sees fit. But a group of community activists and organizers has been calling on the justices of the peace to use the money to provide Washington County residents with things like rental assistance or utility assistance. They've also been calling on the JPs to hold a public discussion about how the funding should be used. And they finally got that at Tuesday night's Finance and Budget Committee meeting.
Okay, the public got to comment on all of this, and we're going to get to that. But what did the JPs have to say about it?
Let me preface this by saying that there are 7 JPs on the Finance and Budget Committee, but other members of the 15-person quorum court joined in the discussion, which they can do. So we didn't just hear from JPs who are on the committee. We heard from JPs who are on the overall quorum court. As you can imagine, there was a variety of opinions ranging from spending the money on rental assistance to keeping it in the so-called rainy day fund or the county reserves. Here's a little bit of what the JPs had to say. You'll hear from Jim Wilson, Judith Yanez, Suki Hires, and Evelyn Rios Stafford in this montage.
Now, the sales tax numbers indicate that Northwest Arkansas does a whole lot better than the rest of the state does. But I hope that our people are understanding that there are jobs available in Northwest Arkansas, and they have the opportunity to be working. I hope they understand that.
This pandemic and COVID has hit families where they're devastated. Sick community, spouses that have died, mothers that are now staying home with their kiddos that can't work. And unless you're in tune to all this, you don't realize the impact that this money can have within the community.
We have families that are losing their homes. I have students that I have lost track of because they have become homeless. I have students who have dropped out of school because they are having to work to support their families.
Stabilizing the local community, it will help our own tax base. If we don't help people on the front end, we're going to be paying more on the back end in terms of lost tax revenue. Using money to stimulate the local community means more sales tax. And the rainy day is here right now. Thank you.
You just heard from Justices of the Peace Jim Wilson, Judith Yanez, Suki Hires, and Evelyn Rios Stafford there. So, Zuzanna Sitek, where do county finances stand during the pandemic? Does this reimbursement cover any kind of deficit?
So it doesn't look like it. And according to a presentation from the county treasurer during Tuesday's meeting, Washington County received about $8.5 million from the 1% sales tax last year. That's an increase of 8% over 2019. So the county did better in that regard than it did in a non-pandemic year. The county is also going into 2021 with $5.4 million in its reserves. During the meeting, Justice of the Peace Sam Duncan described the county as being in the hole for $8 million after $13 million in COVID-19 related expenses and the $4.5 million reimbursement. But JP Eva Madison went on to point out that in the county's application for reimbursement, their application to the state, the county received the exact amount it had requested. And all of it was reimbursement for salaries in the sheriff's office and jail, which had already been accounted for in the 2020 budget. I'll let Madison explain that point a little bit more.
That is not expenditures that we incurred because of COVID. Those were expenditures we were going to incur regardless of COVID. And so to say that we need to save this because we're out of pocket money is just perpetuating a lie, to be honest. We are not in the whole $13 million. All of that $13 million, all of this $4.5 million at issue was in our budget last year.
That was Justice of the Peace, Eva Madison. The JPs also, as we've mentioned, took comment from the public about this money. What did we hear from county residents?
There was a 12-minute public comment session at the end of the meeting. The sentiments from residents were similar to those expressed by the JPs. There were some who said the county should hold on to the money because the pandemic isn't over yet. Hmm. Others wanted to put at least a portion of the money into helping Washington County residents. Here's just a couple of the comments we heard.
I also support the thoughts that the 4.5, the use of the funds, cannot be responsibly assessed. The needs past that, spending that 7.1, cannot be responsibly assessed until you've spent the 7.1. And then once you've spent that money, you can figure out where you are and what you need to do at that point.
I'd like the quorum court to consider that these are actual people that we're talking about, not servicing versus putting this money in a bucket. So how do you justify for saying you're going to save money while people are homeless, hungry, and living in poverty and possibly dying in our communities because we want to save money?
By the end of the evening, the JPs ended up hearing from five people. There were others in line to speak. So JP Judith Yanez made a motion to extend public comment by another 12 minutes, but that motion failed. And I should also note there was a group of renter advocates who held a small rally outside the Washington County Courthouse to greet the JPs who came to the meeting in person.
All right. One of the speakers mentioned another $7.1 million that's been received by the county. You reported on that last week, but remind us where that funding stands.
So this is another funding stream, the $7.1 million that was brought up during the meeting several times, comes from the most recent round of federal relief funding and is intended specifically for rent and utility assistance. Last week, the county appropriated $1.5 million each to the Fayetteville Housing Authority and the Springdale Housing Authority to start distributing that money. But it remains to be seen if that $7.1 million will be enough. According to Moody's Analytics, across the nation, the situation for renters is pretty bleak. Moody's estimates that as of January, there are more than 10 million delinquent renters who owe an average of $5,500 in back rent per household. And they say the $25 billion included in the latest round of federal relief will be enough to help 3.5 million people, which means over 6 million will not get assistance. And I also think it's important to point out that from speaking with renter advocates and renters themselves the last few months, it's not that people aren't working right now. Many of them are, but they either lost their jobs completely or lost hours earlier in the pandemic, and they can't get caught up on the rent they owe, even if they're able to pay rent right now. So a lot of those renters are actually still in their homes, mostly because of the eviction moratorium that's been extended through March 31st. But that might not be the case when the moratorium runs out.
So this conversation, and right now it's still just conversation, will continue for some time.
I believe so. I believe the advocates who would like to see that money go to help Washington County residents plan to keep pushing for that.
Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek getting us up to date on Washington County Quorum Court and money from the federal government. Zu, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
It's important to know what's going on, but keeping up can be a lot, especially with those news alerts blowing up your phone, leaving you stressed and confused. When you need some shelter, a safe haven from the noise, you turn to public radio. I'm Jen White, and KUAF is your space for respectful, thoughtful dialogue and reporting that breaks down the big ideas. Bring yourself future moments of peace. Give online at supportkuaf.com.
You can hear 1A with Jen White every Monday through Friday from 9 to 11 a.m. on 91.3 KUAF. This is Ozarks at Large. The Arkansas Cinema Society is committed to several tenets: improving access to movies of all kinds for Arkansans, increasing the number of professionals who can work in the film industry and not leave the state, and place a major spotlight on Arkansas films and filmmakers. The Arkansas Cinema Society originated in central Arkansas, but it's expanding its footprint into northwest Arkansas. In conjunction with that growth, there is a film screening tomorrow at the 112 Drive-In of Minari, the 2020 Sundance Audience Award winner from director Lee Isaac Chung, who grew up in Lincoln. Following the movie, there will be a filmed question and answer session between Chung and Jeff Nichols, a co-founder of the Arkansas Cinema Society and the writer and director of Loving and Mud. Yesterday, we reached Catherine Tucker, another co-founder of the Society, via Zoom. We talked to her about the greater mission of the Arkansas Cinema Society, and we'll hear much of that conversation next week on Ozarks. Tonight, we wanted to hear about the Arkansas premiere of Minari. She says bringing the movie to the 112 Drive-In is part of the group's aim.
There's many layers to our mission, but that's one of our missions as well, is to bring films that might not be seen in a place normally, and highlighting all of these amazing films that are out there and bringing them to our audience in Arkansas. And, you know, Minari is a great example. It's absolutely 100% in line with our mission. And it actually kind of gives me chills a little bit, because it, you know, this is a filmmaker that grew up in Arkansas and still has connections here, but has gone off and thought filmmaking seemed like a faraway dream, and had actually given up on it a little bit and gone. And he was, a professor and loved doing that. But, you know, obviously now he's back on track being a filmmaker, but Lee Isaac Chung is his name, but he grew up in Lincoln. And, you know, we recorded the Q&A with Jeff yesterday and Isaac, and, you know, they had never met. So there's all different layers of connection that I think, hopefully, we're provided, that ACS is providing. But Minari won the Audience Award in 2020. It's set in Arkansas, was shot in Oklahoma, and it's up for a lot of awards. And here, this very talented Arkansan, we're able to share his work to a wide audience here in Arkansas, and that's one of the things that Jeff and I have both said is, you know, Jeff has films that he was like, you know, I want to have a screening of Loving, but how do I do that? Before we started the Arkansas Cinema Society. So now we're kind of a resource. And I had reached out to A24 to see if we could screen Minari at our film festival, Filmland, in October. And they said, you know, we're not ready to screen it at more festivals right now, but when we are, we will reach back out to you. And they did, which was amazing. And we were able to put together this amazing partnership event in Northwest Arkansas at the Drive-In and create kind of this hometown screening for a filmmaker. And that's really our dream and our mission. And, you know, so it's really coming to fruition in a lot of ways, but I love it. And the film is amazing. It's an incredible film.
I want to talk about the film just a little bit more in a minute. What I love about the Thursday night event is it's old school. It's at the Drive-In, and it's very 2021 in that you can watch it virtually at the same time.
Right. Yeah. So we wanted to provide our audience, everyone in our audience, an opportunity to see the film. Unfortunately and fortunately, the virtual screening is now sold out. I think there's a few spots left at the Drive-In. There'll be more opportunities to see the film, but maybe not for free. I'll tease that. But yeah, there's a few more spots at the drive-in, but the drive-in has a 280 car capacity. So to me, for our, for the screening to be sold out virtually already, it sold out in 24 hours. And then for the drive-in to be as packed as it is, you know, it's just awesome.
It's a nice problem to have.
It's a great problem to have.
Without giving too much away, give us the 3 or 4 minute synopsis of the film.
Sure. So it's based loosely on Lee Isaac Chung's life growing up in Lincoln, Arkansas. It's about his family's return, not necessarily return, but they moved to Arkansas from California. And it's about the trials of their family, you know, being new in a place, trying to make a living. It's a lot about the family dynamics and, you know, how, what it felt like as a child. It's in some ways it's kind of told from the child's point of view, but it's not, because there's a lot of, you know, dramatic relationship development between the mom and the dad. I'm probably not giving the best summary of
it. Well, you don't want to give anything away.
No, but it's really insightful. And I think, you know, the dad and the mom, their job is chicken sexing. So something everyone in Arkansas is very familiar with, but I had never like seen that happen, you know, seeing that happen and thinking about, you know, making a life of being the fastest chicken sexer, which is essentially what his dad was. So he was really, really fast. So he came to Arkansas where, you know, that's where chicken sexing is in high demand. So it's really an amazing, authentic Arkansas story about immigrants that came to Arkansas, and their pursuit of, you know, the American dream in our state.
I'm wondering if you were a young person in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and you wanted to make films and you were growing up in small town Arkansas, you more than likely thought, I got to leave to do it. And I'm wondering, seeing a film from a Lincoln, a young man who grew up in Lincoln, and seeing it about his hometown, and now with the technology available, and now with the assist from the Arkansas Cinema Society, if just more young people, or I guess people of all ages, will think, oh, I can do that without having to quit my job and move mm-hmm. away.
Right, exactly. And that's kind of our point, too. You know, you just crystallized what it is we're doing, and that someone in the audience might think, I can do that. And it lights a spark, and or it sparks a fire, whatever that saying is.
It can do it either.
but it, you know, lights their fuse, so to speak. And I think it's absolutely the case. And I feel extremely encouraged about, you know, where Arkansas is headed in terms of filmmaking. But, you know, someone reminded me, you know, that you have to lead by example. And when people see that, exactly as you said, you know, Lee Isaac Chung is winning Sundance, grew up in Lincoln. It's an inspiring story. Just that, you know, the story behind the filmmaker, I think, is as inspiring as the film.
Catherine Tucker is a co-founder of the Arkansas Cinema Society, and she spoke with us yesterday via Zoom. The Arkansas premiere of Minari from filmmaker Lee Isaac Chung, who grew up in Lincoln, takes place tomorrow night at the 112 Drive-In in Fayetteville. There were, as of yesterday, limited spaces left for the screening at the drive-in. The virtual spots all sold out, but there will be other chances to see the film. We'll pass along that information soon. More from our conversation with Catherine and with Cody Ford, who was recently hired by the Arkansas Cinema Society as its Northwest Arkansas Program Director, on an edition of Ozarks at Large next week. More information available at ArkansasCinemaSociety.org.
KUAF is supported by Biotech Pharmacal. Biotech is committed to supporting a healthy and active lifestyle through pure, hypoallergenic vitamins and supplements. Today, celebrating the 90th birthday of founder Dale Benedict, biotechpharmacal.com, where energy equals health.
This is Ozarks at Large. After a few days of fewer deaths reported from COVID-19 in Oklahoma, the past 2 days have contained bleak news. Today, the Oklahoma State Department of Health counted 30 additional deaths from the virus. Yesterday, 53 additional deaths. There have now been 3,900 fatal cases of COVID-19 in Oklahoma. Earlier today, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued a statement advising people to make sure masks fit properly, and the CDC advising double masking as an approach to help slow the spread of COVID-19. This directive comes as a warning as variants of the virus, considered much more contagious, become more active in the United States. Now, on a brighter note, some area artists are being recognized by the Arkansas Arts Council. Trout Fishing in America, the musical duo based in Northwest Arkansas, being honored with the 2021 Lifetime Achievement Award from the Arkansas Arts Council. Keith Grimwood and Ezra Eidlett continue to write and record music, their most recent work coming out during this pandemic and recorded in Northwest Arkansas. Joe Doster of Huntsville, a woodworker and retired educator, is this year's Folk Life Award winner. He's long been a member of the Arkansas Craft Guild and a founding president of the Arkansas Craft School. And the Bob Bogle family of Bentonville being honored with the Arkansas Arts Council Patron Award, recognizing the family's more than 50-year patronage of arts and culture in the region and the state. A virtual celebration of all the honorees scheduled for next month.
Hello, my name is Rhonda Dillard. Did you know that KUF listeners could become your best customers? KUF listeners find value in public radio, and research shows that 85% of public radio listeners are more likely to support a business or service that they heard about on public radio. So if you enjoy listening to KUAF, why not invite your fellow listeners to become your customers? Email Rhonda at KUAF.com to receive more information.
We've passed the 30-day mark of the current edition of the General Assembly in Arkansas, and yesterday's business included discussion of a proposed bill to penalize any school wanting to access the New York Times Long Form 1619 project as a resource for teaching history. That failed in a House committee. It also included conversation about a proposed designed framework for classroom instruction about African American history. Yesterday, Roby Brock, with our partner Talk Business and Politics, talked with Representative Reginald Murdoch, a Democrat from Marianna, about those matters and the session's progress overall. The conversation, part of the daily coverage of the legislative session at talkbusiness.net.
Before we get into some issues of the session here, I want to get a little bit more. We're at the 30-day mark of the legislature. Give me your assessment of where we're at. It seems like we've spent a lot of time talking about a lot of social and cultural issues, not so much on the business of state government. Why is that?
Absolutely. And as you well know, Robbie, for being a veteran on the Hill, that's a little different than the way we usually do it. We started out with standing your ground, and it's been pretty much really taken over a lot of the session so far, either in and out of session, in and out of committees. And that's been a big part of the topic, along with some other social. Of course, we're starting to get to the business a little bit now. We've got some budget bills moving through, some appropriations. But yeah, it's been a little different than what it usually is, because usually we don't hit some of those bills till later in the session. But we started out with a bang, with that stand your ground. And now we're also starting to deal with some more stuff there that will be a little more substantive, I think, as we get a little further.
Let's talk about, you're on the House Education Committee. There was a big debate today in the House Education Committee over House Bill 1231. This puts restrictions on the teaching of the 1619 project. That bill failed in committee. Tell me what you think won that debate for your position.
Well, I think it was two stories going on there. I think the position of censorship. Basically, we were going to, in Little Rock, we were going to determine what curriculum, what was going to be taught. We were going to ignore those that have been trained to develop curriculums and that are responsible at the local level, quite frankly, to make that happen. We thought that it's better that that stay in those hands. I think, secondly, the 1619 project itself, to me, secondarily, was the issue. The process of education and delivery of education is what was at stake to me. And though 1619 was a subject matter, I think when we get involved in determining and taking it away from those that should determine, then we mess up the process of education. And I think we corrected that today in a good manner by pushing back that 1231 legislation.
And I don't have to tell you, Democrats such as yourself are in the super minority in the Arkansas legislature. So it was a bipartisan rejection of that bill. The House sponsor, Representative Mark Lowry, said he's not planning to bring the bill back up. And he also is not planning to run House Bill 1218, which is another bill that deals with restricting schools and teachers being able to teach social justice and diversity and inclusion. Are you satisfied with that result? Have you talked to Representative Lowry about it?
I have talked to him, and I am satisfied with that. I tell you, the best offense sometimes is a good defense, and that's what we're trying to play here, to make sure that we keep those things confined that we think could be damaging to the process and to the educational system.
A big debate today down in the state Senate over Senate Concurrent Resolution 6, which is basically an 11-page recitation of Black history in America. If you want to go through all that, I interviewed Senator Sullivan earlier on this. He's one of the lead sponsors. Well, what's your take on Senate Resolution 6? You've had a chance to look at it.
Well, yeah, I've read the 11 pages. And it's an interesting read in that it talks a lot about the evolution, and it honors some Black leaders and the evolution of the slavery trade and those that were instrumental in breaking us away from that emancipation of that. But then it kind of turns and pivots to me, a more political slant as it talks about the Democratic Party and what the Democratic Party and John Kennedy, President Kennedy, and others were kind of vilified in that resolution. So I don't really know what that was all about. I don't know the productivity of that. I don't know if it's just a result of the day that we're living in today. I don't know what that was all about. It started out really in places honoring those that have done great things in the African-American community and Blacks, but it also had a political slant. So I hadn't really had a chance to digest it, to be honest with you. I read it and just seen it yesterday for the first time. So I read it today and yesterday, and I'm still gleaning because there's 11 pages. There's quite a bit in there.
Yeah. So I talked with Senator Sullivan, and I think his heart is in the right place in that he said this is Black History Month. He wanted to do something to honor Black history and put some of this together so that it could be shared with schools and the community. At the same time, when I asked him why there were no African-American sponsors on this legislation, he said he'd had some conversations with some of the Black legislators, but they didn't agree to come on. What advice would you give for Senator Sullivan or any of these other legislators that are on this resolution to work with African-American legislators on a bill about African-American history?
Well, it just makes all the sense in the world that we would be on that bill. And I would love to have been on a bill that made sense. So certainly we did not see this. I did not see it. Let me speak to that for sure. And I had not heard about it from any of my other Black legislative colleagues until now. So I don't know who they consulted with, but I think we could have helped them with that and made that document. Because I know Dan Sullivan, I think he's a great guy, and his heart probably is well. But inclusion is for a reason. We could have helped them make that document probably more toward what they intended it to be. I applaud them for the effort, for sure. And certainly, I appreciate that they at least thought about us, but I wish we could have been a part of the effort.
All right. Lastly, stand your ground. It's going to be back at some point in time in one of these committees or on that House floor. It's kind of the last line of defense for those who oppose stand your ground legislation. I believe you are on that side of the debate right there. What's your strategy for keeping that bill from landing on the governor's desk? It looks like they can make some changes and get it out of committee, or they probably do have the votes to pull it to the House floor.
Well, some of that's yet to be seen. We're doing a lot of discussion about that behind the scenes, to be honest with you. I don't know that it gets to the House floor through the extraction process. And I think that probably will not happen. I'd like to say to you that I think that will not happen. I think that the things that are egregious in that bill is egregious to a lot of people for a lot of reasons. I think politically, some people were put in a tough position, but I think the merits of the bill says that it should not pass and it should not become law because of those two very egregious areas in it, the retreat part and then the part about the individual that's just thinking that they're threatened. They become the judge, jury, and executioner. Those two pieces of that bill are very, very problematic, and I think they're problematic across party lines. I think the politics, though, of the day put some people in tough positions. So let's see how it play out. We're going to continue to hope that it stay where it is now, which is dead and not and it doesn't go any further. So hopefully we can be successful with that. But you, as you well know, it's still live. It's still live.
State Representative Reginald Murdoch is a Democrat from Marianna, and he talked with Roby Brock from our partner Talk Business and Politics yesterday. The conversation part of Roby's ongoing daily coverage of the legislative session at talkbusiness.net. You can also find Roby's conversation with State Senator Dan Sullivan of Jonesboro at talkbusiness.net. And speaking of daily coverage, don't forget, Antoinette Grajeda keeps you up to date with news from around the state and from around our region every weekday morning at 5:30 and 7:30, Inside Morning Edition on KUAF 91.3.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. KUAF is supported by Dr. Kathleen Wong, providing in-office ketamine infusion therapy for treatment of depression and anxiety disorders. Following protocol established by the NIMH, ketamine therapy is an effective alternative when other treatments fail. Located in Fayetteville and online at drwongketamine.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. Much of the nation's attention this week is focused on the impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump in the United States Senate. This month, 19 years ago, we were concentrating on a different trial, one that had taken place more than 100 years earlier. There was about to be a reenactment of sorts of a trial of Federal Marshal Bass Reeves. We traveled to Fort Smith to talk with Tom Wing, then a park ranger and historian for the National Park Service at the Fort Smith Historic Site, about the event.
Well, we're going to go back to 1887, and they were still in this courtroom at that time. They didn't leave this one until 1889 and moved down the street into a new building. So, you know, the daily business would have been, liquor violations and, thievery and larceny, and then there would be some murder cases that would come before here, too. So you would see a court in action in this very room.
Before we talk about the trial itself, should mention that Bass Reeves is one of the most fascinating figures in Fort Smith history.
A very compelling story behind Bass Reeves and what we do know about him, some of which is kind of difficult and cloudy and hard to find, but through a cooperative effort, I guess, of the park, some of our staff and volunteers, and then along with two members of the academic community, Art Burton and Nudie Williams, a professor up at the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville, we've been able to pull a lot of these things out and together to go over a very important part of his life. But Bass's history, he's involved in some of the biggest cases. Ned Christie was to name one, but the stories that we get from him, going into disguise to catch outlaws and gaining their confidence and then surprising them with his true identity is really the stuff that movies are made of.
At the time that Bass Reeves was alive, he was a well-known figure in Fort Smith and West, wasn't he? I mean, he was famous.
He had a reputation, for being a very, very good lawman. We know from looking at the financial records of the court and of the marshal's office, who would be responsible for paying the deputy marshals that went out and did the work, that Bass was one of the highest paid. So he was working very hard. That involved, taking a wagon and hiring a cook and hiring a guard and taking a handful of warrants and subpoenas and going out into the territories and rounding up these prisoners over time and then bringing them back to Fort Smith all in one load to get paid. But he does have a very good reputation. He brought a lot of people to justice. He had a very high respect for the law and that's what you see in the cases he was involved in. He was also involved in bringing his own son to justice for some crimes that he committed. So, that tells you a little bit about his character.
So how does Bass Reeves find himself on trial for murder?
He's got a camp set up out in the Chickasaw Nation. He's serving warrants and paperwork, and at the time of the incident, he had 11 prisoners in the camp. He had a cook, he had a teamster, a young boy who drove his wagon for him, and he had a posseman or a guard with him, but the posseman was not present at the time. What happens is his Winchester rifle discharges. His statement on it is that it was accidental. He had a stuck cartridge. The prisoners who were in his camp said that there was an argument, and he got crossways with his cook, and that's what precipitated the gun firing, and that's how he ended up in court. The cook was shot. The cook died as a direct or indirect result of the wound. It's not completely clear, but he did die shortly after, and Baskett's brought up on charges for that.
He's charged, but it's 3 years before the trial takes place.
That's what also is interesting. If you look at the record and look at everything that's there, Bass continues to do his job. He had tried to get medical attention for the cook, and there's a lot of other circumstances that go along with that. But it took time to round up the witnesses and the accusations to come full circle, and for them to have to finally investigate this and bring charges against. When you're dealing with outlaws and people who have been brought before the court, some of those guys are kind of hard to find as witnesses after they've been dealt with and disappeared back into the territories.
He manages, though, to get three of the best known and three of the best attorneys in Fort Smith.
That's true. He hires the counsel of Thomas Markham, William Murphy Cravens, and Judge Clayton, who used to be the prosecutor for Parker. Clayton is on and off as prosecutor here over time, and this is a time period when he's actually in private practice. But these were the most expensive, the best of the best in Fort Smith. And you know, at that time in the mid 1880s, there are a lot of lawyers in Fort Smith, and some of them are very good at their craft. So he didn't go the budget route. He got the best he could get. What we've found in that. And one of our local volunteers, Al Drapp, who works here at the park for us in various capacities on a volunteer basis, researched real estate records, and he found some very enlightening information that showed that Bass even mortgaged his own house to pay the lawyers for their fees. So, you know, that shows you how back up against the wall, you know, he was at this point.
You have one of the most famous lawmen in the West, certainly one of the most distinguishable. You have a judge who is perhaps rightly called a living legend at this point. You have the most prominent attorneys in Fort Smith. You have a murder case. This had to be talk of the town.
Talk of the town, yes. But what we've seen in the records is talk of the press has been very quiet on it, and that brings out something else. You know, it's being Black History Month. This was a very important decision for us to choose this case because it tells us some things about the time. And being talk of the town, you know, it would have been on everybody's mind. It would have been all the coffee shops and everywhere, yet you read the newspaper and it's strangely quiet about the situation. And in fact, when the verdict is read, it's almost a side note on the page. So, you know, that shows you a little bit about a man with a reputation, but at that time in history, being of the color he was, that affected things.
I can't imagine anyone who has any kind of relationship with history or even romantic notions not being excited to be here after dark, and the jury came back with their verdict after dark in the courtroom in the building where this took place.
Yeah, that's a lot of the appeal, is to get in here after hours when it's not daylight and you're not dealing with park visitors and all the other stuff. The atmosphere, we'll do our best to try and recreate the feel of 1887 and to go over the case and let people, you know, close their eyes for a moment and be back in the 1880s for a little while. So hopefully if we do our job right, that'll be the result.
Tom Wing speaking to us in February 2002 about a planned reenactment of a trial featuring Bass Reeves, a federal marshal. Tom Wing was then a park ranger and historian for the National Park Service at the Fort Smith Historic Site. He's now director of the Drennan Scott Historic Site that's part of the University of Arkansas Fort Smith. Bass Reeves was well known by people in western and northwest Arkansas then, but not perhaps so much by people beyond our region. Now, 19 years later, Reeves has been a central part of the storytelling in the HBO series The Watchmen and the subject of the movie Hell on the Border, released last year on BET. our ability to bring back archive material from the past 31 years of Ozarks at Large is supported by the Women's Giving Circle at the University of Arkansas. And thanks to Timothy Dennis for the work to bring this piece out of the archives for us tonight.
It's the Community Spotlight on KUAF. I'm Pete Hartman. Today, over the phone line here in the Nancy Blair Operations Studio, we're joined once again with Amy Wilson with Beaver Water District. Amy, always nice to talk to you.
Always nice to talk with you too, Pete.
Of course, BWD, as it's known to so many, basically serving much, if not all, of Northwest Arkansas with our clean water needs.
Beaver Water District, since the 1960s, has been taking water from Beaver Lake, making it clean to drink, and then we wholesale that water to Fayetteville, Springdale, Rogers, and Bentonville. As is the case with so many organizations and institutions, the ongoing pandemic has changed how we deliver education and information to the community. Now, fortunately for us, we had already filmed much of the footage for a virtual drinking water plant tour when the pandemic hit a year ago. And then to finish filming, we followed protocols and we forged ahead. We got the job done. So we've got the virtual drinking water plant tour that's up on our website now. And it gives you the feeling that you're walking around the plant and you're getting to see how drinking water is produced. The other exciting thing is that we have land use, land change games. These presented a bigger challenge. They had been designed for hands-on use with immersive touchscreen kiosks in our Water Education Center, which is on site at our Administration Center in Lowell. Well, with the pandemic, we had to close our plant site and Administration Center to the public. But what we did is we worked really hard to transition those immersive touchscreen water, land use, land change games to a laptop, desktop computer game scenario. So there are three of those, and those complement lessons and activities on our website that address not only drinking water treatment, but Beaver Lake and its watershed, and all of it meets K through 12 standards for teaching in the classroom.
So many opportunities from the website and from Beaver Water District itself. Okay, again, that website, that's bwdh20.org. Speaking with Amy Wilson, if someone is interested in some of these educational offerings, what's a good email possibly?
education@bwdh20.org.
Amy Wilson with Beaver Water District. Always fun talking to you and learning a little more about how our water gets to us and all of the different things that's got to happen to make it clean.
Thank you so much, Pete, for the opportunity today.
The Community Spotlight and KUAF, local matters.
This is 91.3 KUAF Fayetteville, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Contributors tonight included Susanna Sitek. Timothy Dennis produced our show and did the work to get the archive on our show this evening. And again, thanks to the Women's Giving Circle at the University of Arkansas for providing support so we can air pieces from the past 31 years of our program on these 2021 editions of Ozarks at Large. The Community Spotlight, produced by Pete Hartman inside the Nancy Blair Operations Studio here at the Carver Center for Public Radio in downtown Fayetteville. We'll be back with you tomorrow night at 7, our noon show tomorrow, most likely preempted by NPR's live special coverage of the impeachment trial of the U.S. Senate. You can have gavel-to-gavel coverage of that trial if you go to KUAF.com. Ozarks at Large is a production of 91.3 KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. We will be back with you again tomorrow night at 7 for a Thursday edition of our show.